Okay, this is a paper session on radio in installation art. And the first person we're going to be speaking with is Andrew O'Connor, who is presenting Frequencies Dawson City. And Andrew O'Connor is a transmission artist based in Toronto. His work for radio has been featured on numerous programs across CBC Radio 1 and 2, such as Inside the Music, The Signal, and Metro Morning, as well as syndicated internationally on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Radio Zero in Lisbon, and WGXC in upstate New York. Andrew's installation and sound design work has been presented by the Vancouver New Music Festival, the Third Coast Filmless Festival, Megapolis, and was recently featured in a multidisciplinary theater project called Boblo that premiered in December 2012 at the Theater Center in Toronto. Please help me welcome Andrew O'Connor.
Thank you. So as was mentioned, I'll be talking about a recent project of mine called Frequencies Dawson City. I didn't write a formal paper or anything, but I'm just going to talk about the project and how it came together and play some clips from it. So the piece was a commission from the Klondike Institute for Art and Culture, which is for short known as KIAC, in Dawson City, Yukon. It's part of their yearly thematic series called The Natural and the Manufactured. It was a site-specific public installation for a series of low-watt FM transmitters that were sort of placed around the city of Dawson in windows and storefronts. And each transmitter is broadcasting on the same frequency, 107.9 FM in this instance. And they're laid out in an array around the city that creates this sort of zone where if you walk through it with a radio tuned, different transmitters are going to fall in and out of range. Each transmitter is broadcasting a different loop of stories and sounds, reflections about the physical space location where you are, the buildings, the landscape around you, and the memories attached to those places. So just to get sort of the boring tech stuff out of the way, how it was achieved, I had 12 of these mini FM transmitters. I think they're about 100 milliwatts. Made by Canakit, which is a company out of Vancouver that Anna Frizz directed me to, and they make some great stuff. And so there was 12 of these, and each one of these was connected to a cheap little MP3 player. I bought them in bulk. I think I paid about $11 for each one. Basically, it's an iPod Nano ripoff. So it's just this really, it's very simple, almost stupid machine that just plays, as long as it has power, after you press play, it will just keep playing whatever's on here over and over and over again until it either runs out of power or you press stop. So I had to figure out a way to keep this powered, so I got these little generic USB chargers. So you plug it right into the wall, plug a USB in here, into this, and I pressed play the day I installed it, and it ran for 6 or 7 weeks. Nobody ever had to touch it, do anything with it. So that worked out really well, the technical aspect of it. And it's, again, very simple, not terribly expensive way to do this. So as I said, each MP3 had a different loop of sounds and stories about the place where you are physically located, and each one is a different length, anywhere from, I think the shortest one was 8 or 9 minutes, longest one was 14 or 15 minutes. So as you're walking through, the points of intersection are constantly in flux. So nobody ever experiences the same order of stories, the same juxtaposition of narratives twice in this project. And so that's sort of a general explanation of it. Just a little bit of a background to Dawson City, Yukon. If you're not familiar with your Canadian geography, it is in the far north of Canada, northwest. Closest city is Whitehorse. Closest thing you could really consider a city is Whitehorse. And that's about 500 kilometers south. So it's pretty much in the middle of nowhere. What put it on the map was, I guess originally it was a fish camp for the Trondek-Huechen First Nation, who it's right at the confluence of the Klondike River and the Yukon River, and so they'd come down there every year for the salmon run and catch a year's worth of salmon. Then gold was discovered there. It was the center of the gold rush, and a huge boom came that eventually petered out, and it sort of became this ghost town, and it was kind of abandoned. People still lived there, but most of the buildings were empty and boarded up. Until Parks Canada came along in the 70s and turned it into a national historic site. So they refurbished all the buildings, and it's now a national historic complex. So the whole downtown, if you can call it downtown, of the city is preserved architecturally and design-wise in that era. So if you own a house in this district, you can only have a tin roof, use a specific kind of siding. It's all, so it created this interesting dynamic because it is this growing city and it's becoming popular and people want to move there, but it's becoming popular because it's frozen in time. And actually I have a little slideshow queued up of just some of the places in Dawson, and you can see the little transmitters in some of the shots. And these are sort of the locations I had them placed around Dawson. And so I came to Dawson with the structure in mind for this piece, with a series of transmitters, and I had these aspects about the city that interest me that I thought would be good fodder for a project like this. But I was adamant that I wanted the content and the specific locations of the project to be determined by the people who live there and the way the city sounds and feels. So basically, it was a two-month residency, and for the first probably month and change, I just kind of went out at different times of the day and just kind of hung out with my recorder, made field recordings, tried to do some interviews with people and talk to people who live there. That was a bit of a slow process. It kind of snowballed. At first, it was hard to approach these people because some of them, I mean, the gallery gave me a list of great storytellers and people who live there that I should talk to. But the bulk of the material just came from me striking up conversations with people. And this is kind of a remote northern community, and you couldn't just walk up to somebody and say, I'm an artist from Toronto, and shove a microphone in their face. That wasn't going to work. So it was a slower process. I had to kind of hang out, chat with them. And then once I started talking to some of them, they're like, oh, you got to talk to my buddy, and you got to talk to this guy. And I ended up with 10 to 12 hours of interview material that I had to go through for this project, and probably twice that in soundscape recordings. And so as I sort of collected these stories and this material and started to edit it down, different themes started to emerge. Different locations had more stories attached to them than others, and that's how I sort of structured, that's sort of the skeleton of the project that I built everything around. Now, one of the recurring stories that kept coming up is during this sort of time when the city was abandoned, squatting was very prominent. Probably half the city was squatting in abandoned buildings. And everybody who grew up there has all these stories about just breaking into these buildings and having parties and drinking beer as a teenager. And so I collected, so this clip I'm going to play you, I have an example of it, is some of those stories. And this was, you would hear this, this transmitter was placed right actually in the Oddfellows Ballroom, which is where the Kayak Gallery is. And it's right beside a lovely Victorian inn called the Bombay Peggy's, which has been refurbished, but back in the day was actually a brothel. And it's got lots of stories attached to that. So here's a little clip from what you would have heard if you were standing in front of Kayak.
You know, it's just a huge.
We used to crawl in between. Like, it was boarded up, but then we managed to, you know, push the boards out of the way and crawl inside. And I just remember it being really dark, but we had to. It didn't even have a floor.
Everybody always talked about having found a skeleton in there, and you know, it was supposedly regalia from the Odd Fellows, and I don't even know if that was ever true, but I'm sure a lot of people will tell you that story.
Bombay Peggy's was also another one. It used to sit on Front Street. I remember specifically going into that building because that's when we first heard about Bombay Peggy herself, and that's when we found out it was a brothel, and so we kind of thought that was kind of cool at the time when we were kids, and we were like, wow, there used to be ladies that used to stay in these rooms. And so we would wander. I recall staying one night there. There's a group of us that used to run away from home when I was a kid around Dawson, and we would hide out in some of these places and stay in some of these old abandoned buildings. And there was Bombay Peggy's that we ended up staying one night in, and I remember kind of looking through one of the walls and seeing the sawdust in there, and then the old rundown, there was wallpaper on the walls, and I think there was some coins that somebody else must have left that we ended up taking.
Hang out, and it had so many layers and levels of it. And there was just always a mob of people in there, some natives, some white people. Everybody'd hang out there and could go in there. I think it's amazing when these two girls looked at that building and said, well, why don't we take this falling down old 100-year-old rickety brothel, pick it up out of this sunken muck it's in.
We ended up actually hiding away because somebody was looking for us. We ended up hiding away in the crevice of the wall. We'd hid away in there, and we actually slept in this little kind of hole in the wall. I remember laying on sawdust and how sticky or kind of jabbed me a little bit
when I was working
in the back when I was laying down when we were trying to squeeze into this little spot.
There was a party in Bombay Peggy's house for all of the people in the play that was happening in the Palace Grand Theatre at that time. And there was a Johnny Mercer play. It was called musical called Brandy. And all of the star-studded cast there. Bert Lauer was in it. Burl Ives worked for my husband in the Bonanza Hotel.
Anyway, so that gives you a sense of some of the content. And the first voice you heard there, the woman who was talking about hiding out in Bombay Peggy's and finding a little spot in the wall and sleeping there, her name was Georgette McLeod, and she was one of the people that the gallery recommended I speak to. She's a member of the Trondekwetchen First Nation, what the elders jokingly refer to as a junior elder. So she's maybe in her 40s, but very much a leader in the community. And she told just the most wonderful stories. Her everything I got from her was so fantastic. And just like that little thing you heard there about hiding in the wall and feeling the splinters of wood sticking into her back as she's trying to sleep. There was another one. There was a big flood in Dawson in 1979, and I collected a bunch of stories about that. And her story started off, well, I remember I was wearing flower print pajamas, and my grandma came and woke me up. And I love that because it was those really specific memories that I wanted to collect with this. Everybody who lives in Dawson knows there was a flood in 1979, but only Georgette McLeod knows she was wearing flower print pajamas. So the idea was collect as much of that specific material as I can and then start to put it together. There's a Spike Lee quote I'm sure I'm paraphrasing it here, but it says, the more specific the story you tell, the more universal the message becomes. And that was something I really thought about with this project and getting those really specific stories that transcend the actual details and give you a sense of the emotion behind that moment. And it's the emotion that everybody can relate to and that becomes universal, I think, when you get really specific. So I had all this material and I collected it all and I had to figure out a way. I wanted to work with what's often referred to in music as a generative structure. So a thing with several moving parts that are moving at different speeds and intersecting each other at different points to create a constantly evolving soundscape or project. Probably the most famous example would be the Steve Reich tape phasing compositions, It's Gonna Rain, Come Out the Shoulder. But I wanted to do this with narratives. I wanted to do this with storytelling and find a way to continually contrast and juxtapose various stories and various narratives. So really what I had to do is sort of find a new way and not work with the standard arc of beginning, middle, and end, because people aren't necessarily going to hear the entire loop. And even if they do, they might start at minute 3 and listen all the way back around to minute 3. More likely, they're going to start at minute 3 and listen to minute 5.5. So they're not going to hear the whole thing. You're not going to be able to use the standard techniques. So I had to find a way that what you were hearing at this specific location connects in a way to the last transmitter you heard, and hopefully in a way to the next transmitter you're going to hear. But then also within each loop, I tried to have some sense of movement, some sense of progression. And for lack of a better term, what I guess I did was just sort of daisy chain ideas, one off the other. Ideas that related but moved forward or veered to the side a bit from the last clip so that there was a progression to what you're hearing. And I have an example of that. This would have been playing in front of the Midnight Sun, which, as you'll hear, is a fairly loud and rowdy bar and lots of colorful characters.
In this town, I would venture to say that people who may be considered out of the mainstream, maybe verging on mental illness, can kind of hang out in the mainstream in this town just because of the attitude of this town and the acceptance of that sort of behavior, which would be much more exotic in possibly a more staid environment.
Did you make love last year? I know you did, because you were at home. Maybe you're making plans to make love tomorrow night. There's a couple of you here.
I'm all unhappy.
Maybe just one.
Yeah, the beauty of the North, it don't matter how fucked up you are, you'll be welcome with open doors.
You know, there's more Aquarians in the Yukon than there are any other astrological signs. There's more Aquarians in mental institutions than there are any other astrological signs. And frankly, to live in the Yukon, there's a lot more fucking weird people. It's kind of the collective... It's kind of like the collective cesspool of all the problematic personality disorders of Canada end up in the Yukon.
So that has dregs, nothing to do with gold.
The dregs are in Toronto. Fuck you. The dregs are in Toronto. I lost my wife to a lesbian in West Dawson.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And back in the 90s, there were lots of lesbians in West Dawson. Trust me, way more lesbians back then there are now. So we're going to talk about lesbians, and then we're going to talk about the RCMP and their predilection to tag people's vehicles in the middle of the winter instead of going to the donut shop, because there are no donut shops in Dawson. So, of course, the RCMP don't hang out at night. They actually go around and patrol. They dust off people's bumpers. They'll dust off people's license plates to check if your registration tag is the same year that it's supposed to be. Then they'll give you an $87 ticket. It happened to me. Back in 1995. And I thought, why on January 29th at 3:32 in the morning would an RCMP come by my house, brush off my bumper, look at my sticker?
They were actively debating whether or not they wanted to eliminate the RCMP and replace them with localized police forces when the gold rush happened. And they figured that they needed some Canadian presence up here because it was all Americans here, right, during the gold rush. So the RCMP, Sam Steele, he came up. They sent him up here. And all
sure,
of a sudden people
like
realized that
and stuff like that, or leaving your vehicle open.
The RCMP had a role.
We just wouldn't think about locking a door around here. Like, I've never locked my house. Don't lock my vehicle. Most people are the same. For good or bad, whatever. I've had my car stolen once, but out of 30 years, that's not bad. And it only went up the dome. I just had to drive it back down. No big deal.
So that gives you a sense. How sort of I tried to build one idea off the other. So you start with talking about the accepting nature of the people in Dawson, then a drunk guy ranting about Aquarians and people in belonging mental institutions, complaining about the RCMP, then talking about Dawson's role in the fact that there is an RCMP, and then somebody talking about not locking their doors. So the idea is kind of move forward, but not in the standard arc, more sort of in a loop. And just as an interesting side note, the guy there who was complaining about getting a ticket 17 years ago, his name is Curly, and he's a legendary figure, as I'm sure you can imagine, in Dawson City. And that was one of the last nights, assuming he's still on the wagon, that he drank. I bumped into him 3 or 4 weeks later, and he told me he had been sober for 20 days. So assuming he's still on the wagon, I documented one of the town's great drunks and on his last alcohol binge. So if I accomplish nothing else... So I'm sort of running out of time here. I got one more clip I want to play, and I just one more little note. Something that I was really thinking about with this, something that's always fascinated me about radio waves is that they never stop, right? We all know this. Radio waves just keep drifting out and out forever. The very first radio signals that have ever been broadcast are still out there in space somewhere. They get weaker and weaker over time. Things start to interfere and change the signal, but it still exists on some level. And I guess I drew an analogy to memory in that regard. Whereas memories have a specific place and time where they start, but they continue on. They resonate in that location and, you know, again, change and get weaker over time, but it still exists like a radio wave. And this is something that really gelled for me in the months leading up to going to Dawson. I was working at a radio station in Regent Park, which is in the east end of Toronto, and I live in the west end. And so I take these long walks down Queen Street home from Parliament to Roncesvalles, for those of you that know Toronto. And I'd walk through Queen Street West, which is a part of town I used to spend a lot of time in. I worked down there. I spent a lot of time there and just have a lot of memories and experiences attached to that neighborhood. But that neighborhood has changed over many, many times since I've used to spend time there. And it's now a much different place, and I have a much different relationship to it. But those old memories and those old experiences still resonate, and I still sort of feel them on some level as I pass by. But they exist at the same time as these new relationships I have to the place. And so that was, I guess, my thinking, is collect all these loops that the people of Dawson have as they walk through their city and combine them in a way, again, that isn't that isn't an arc, that isn't, you know, when you build a narrative documentary, and I've done lots of that, you have this reveal, this truth at the end that you want everybody to take away, and you start with your intro, and you build an arc so that everybody basically goes on the same journey and leaves with the same takeaway. But in reality, that doesn't ever actually happen because everybody hears things in their own way, interprets it through their own biases, and everybody takes away something different. So I guess with this, I wanted to invert that structure. I wanted to accept that people are going to hear the same stories, but I wanted to create a structure where they don't experience it the same way twice, where everybody gets a unique juxtaposition, a unique composition, essentially. And it's something, and I hate the word interactive because it's such a granting agency buzzword these days, but it really was an interactive thing because you were given a radio and this map with the general locations of the transmitters, and you got to go out and explore it however you wanted. So I was very adamant that it wasn't a walking tour with a start and a finish, but a zone that you can just wander through in any direction at any speed, you know. And there are spots in the installation where you could point your antenna one way and get one signal, and point your antenna a different way and get a different signal. And there are spots where you'd get nothing but static, and you'd have to go out with the map and search for the next signal. So it was very participatory, and I thought it was a real success in that regard. And so I just have one more clip, and I want to set it up, and then we'll get to some questions if there are any. And this relates to Dawson was a great place to do this because there's so many different narratives going on. They've got this really thriving art culture. They've got active gold miners. They've got government workers for Parks Canada, hermits who live out in a log cabin in the woods who come in once a week to drink to town, you know. And so everybody's got these differing opinions and differing ideas of what Dawson is and what Dawson should be. And there's all these different versions of all these crazy stories. And this is going to be an example of one of them. There's a legendary place called the Westminster, which is an old, rickety old hotel, and legend has it, it would be condemned if it ever shut down for a day, but it's open 365 days a year, and because it's a heritage building, it just keeps getting grandfathered to stay open, but if it ever closed for a day, it would shut and be condemned, apparently. And they've got two bars on the main floor, one called the Snake Pit, one called the Armpit, and they're basically open from 9 a.m. until 3 in the morning. So it's that kind of place, and you can imagine there's a lot of stories attached to it. One of the former owners, a British guy named Duncan, legend has it he mined for gold underneath the pit while it was open. And so I got a whole bunch of different versions of this story and weaved them all together. In a way, I don't want to say it's more truthful than a standard narrative, but it had less of my bias in. It wasn't about me finding out, okay, who's telling the truth and who's, you know, making this up. It was about, okay, well, let's weave all these different versions together and then you can decide the truth. So this is part of what you'd hear in front of the pit.
The ground, and they found gold dust there. And our movie theater, a previous owner, came back one day and she said, yeah, we were doing a foundation on this in the 40s, but we thought we would try to the ground. And we panned it all and we got a good amount of gold out of it because it too was a dance hall. And it's possible that the Westminster would have had that too, because gold slips through the floorboards easily.
They were down there, probably Duncan and crew, but who knows for sure. We're down there mining it and kind of got shut down.
I can't say one way or another if there is gold. I know there's a shaft dug. They were doing some exploratory work, we'll say, a few years ago. But they haven't, I don't know if they hit bedrock or pay dirt or anything, but there was attempts. Kind of sworn to secrecy on that one a little bit. But yeah, no, I can't.
It wouldn't surprise me
if they found anything.
A lot of gold dust falls through those floors over the years. And I suspect there's a bit of gold under there. I don't know much, but or whether maybe Duncan has financed his sailboat already on it. I don't know, but whatever the story, I'm sure it's a good one.
You tried to do some mining under the pit. Is there any
Absolutely.
Truth to this?
Of course not. We were just attempting to determine how deep we had to go to find a solid footing from which we could underpin the hotel to build a new foundation. The fact that we were 60 foot down, 64 foot I think, down. You shouldn't really get confused between that hole and the potential mining shaft.
But you didn't find any gold on your way down?
No, no. I think we might have been 10 foot from bedrock.
So it goes on for a bit there, but essentially what he's referring to is the whole town's built on permafrost. So if you try and dig a foundation into the ground, permafrost changes over the years. So that's why half the buildings in Dawson are kind of leaning to one side or sinking in at the front. So he was saying that he wasn't mining for gold. He was simply digging to find an appropriate foundation. I don't know a lot about permafrost, but I don't think it gets better as you dig further down. I think it gets worse. So clearly he wasn't really telling me the truth. And if this were a standard narrative documentary, I would have had to have called bullshit on him. But, you know, I said, okay, if that's your version of the story, that's your version. And we're going to put it with everybody else's version. And, you know, you can make your own decisions as to what went on in that situation. So that's about it. The plan is to make this project into a series, to take this idea and transplant it in other places. Similar to Dawson, with these many layers of history, many narratives going on at once. So, for example, a place like Detroit, or you know, Vancouver, specifically the downtown east side, Chicago, looking at you Radius people, you know. So that's the plan, and hopefully it will go on from there. But it was a great, it was an amazing experience and just a perfect place to really try out this idea. Yeah, so that's it.
Thanks, Andrew. Anyone have any questions, comments, queries?
I know you must have established relationships with these people that you were talking to when you were spending time there. And I was just wondering how they responded to having their voices and their stories in a public format. Mm-hmm. And what happened there?
I got a couple of responses. Initially, whenever I interviewed people, they were afraid to say anything because they're like, oh, well, everybody's going to recognize my voice and I don't want to be telling these stories. And then they'd eventually all sort of open up and you'd get them to tell some good stories. And then once it was up and running, I got the most amazing response from the community. People loved it. People that, and it's funny because Dawson has this sort of arts culture and they have an art school and a big major gallery. But I would say 70% of the town could care less. But this was something that actually people were really impressed because it actually engaged people in the city, and people that I would have never expected to listen to it were driving around in their cars listening to it, stopping me on the street, telling me how much they liked it. And there was an interesting thing about how everybody kind of recognized everybody else's voice. And somebody told me what they knew about this person's background and this person's history influenced how they heard the story. Like, for example, Georgette's story about, you know, when she said there was a group of us that used to run away from home. You know, somebody was talking to me, but like, I knew that person's family situation at the time, and that affected how it was perceived as well. So it led to many different sort of perceptions from depending on who was listening to it and what they knew going into it. I think that answers your question. Okay. Anybody else?
I have a question as well.
Okay.
I think what's interesting is how that the fact that this positive reaction you had from the community, I think, was made possible by the fact it was an installation that they could explore as part of their getting around the town and whatnot, as opposed to something that was broadcast in a more official capacity, whether it be CBC or a community radio station or something like that, that was a one-time thing. I think the fact that the kind of continuous nature and the locative aspect of it, I think, is what actually kind of brought their interest, I think, forward. Is that a correct assumption? And
yeah, I think so. And I think it's correct on a number of levels. It's correct in that people could walk through their surroundings and hear these different stories and explore the piece just going about their daily lives. Like people told me they had their car radio set to it. And they would just drive around. But I think also, because of the structure and the way it was presented, I think that made it more accessible than it would on a community, or maybe more exciting than it would on a community radio station or on the CBC, and that is a fixed structure. Because I feel like there's so many moving parts in that city, and there's so much going on that a fixed structural documentary wouldn't do it justice. And I don't think people would have been engaged with it, because it is so set and everybody in that town has a different opinion on how things should be. So I think the success of that piece was that it embraced that sort of bifurcated nature of the town.
And do you think that's, would that structure not work in other cities or contexts?
I imagine there is places where it wouldn't work. I think the structure works best, you know, in a place like Dawson or in a place like Detroit that has these multiple layers of history. Because if it's just a straight line, it's not as interesting and it doesn't lend itself to this format as well. But when you have all these different ebbs and flows going back and forth, I think that makes the project successful, or I hope it does.
To build on that, I love one of the reasons why I love radio myself and transmitting is that sort of sphere where the transmission, the edge of where the transmission is. So like where it is and then where it ceases to exist. And I think as a viewer or a listener, I suppose, or an activator of the piece, I think that would be one of the fun ways of interacting with it or engaging with it would be that finding that space in between from one transmitter to the next. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think I agree. And I think that space where the edge of these transmissions constantly changes because they're just really low watt transmitters and radio waves are affected by the weather and the time of day. So where those intersections, where those lines are, constantly change with the weather, time of day, you know, if there's cars passing by, whatever, it's constantly in flux, much like the rest of the piece. So that's that was a big part of the structure and the design in my idea.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.